My mistake.
Let's do this again. Can you please help me welcome Steve Lamb from Los Angeles as our speaker tonight?
Steve Lamb, alcoholic.
Steve.
Anything else we need to do before we get started? We're good? Okay. It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. If you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. There were several of you that identified as new, and there may be one or two of you that just couldn't stand up and do that. And if that's one of you, you're still welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're welcome. You're very welcome. It's always an honor and a privilege to share in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank my friend Lee for inviting me up here tonight to share with you. Before I started, Jeremiah and Bradley said, you got a good turnout tonight. It's food. Food. It's the food. I get it. The food was great. Hopefully everybody got a chance to eat. It looked wonderful, and I got some chocolate there. I appreciate that. That's good. And like I said, it's good to be here, and it's good to be sober. My sobriety date is July 27th, 1996, so I've got 20 years and some change, and I almost didn't make it to 20 years. And it's not that I was close to drinking. That's not what happened. What happened is I got shot. On May 21st of last year, I was up at the Seven Circles Retreat Center, which is right near Sequoia National Park. It's outside of Visalia. And I was in my room, sitting on my bed, minding my own business, and the guy upstairs from me decided he needed to clear his 9mm Glock. And he apparently missed a step because he fired a round and it went through the floor that he was standing on, which was the ceiling above me, and it struck me in my chest, in my left part of my chest. It went right past my heart, and it lodged underneath my sternum. Yeah, it'll catch your attention. And I was in the Army for 13 and a half years. I've been shot before, but not in the chest. So I immediately knew I was shot. And I got to tell you, one of the things, if you're new, we work a lot at spirituality and trying to be serene. But I got to tell you, the first word out of my mouth started with an F and ended with a K. And it was not fire truck. And the guy ran downstairs, and he's like, "What happened?" I'm like, "You shot me. That's what happened." He was distraught. He was just out of his mind, distraught. And I went in the bathroom and I got a towel and I stopped the bleeding and I put my finger in the hole because that's what I was taught in the Army. I tried to find the end of the round. I couldn't find the end of the round, so I knew it was pretty deep. But it didn't seem like it hadn't struck any major arteries or my heart or anything, or you wouldn't be hearing me tonight if that had happened. And so I told him you're going to drive me down to the hospital. So he drove me down to the hospital. Normally it takes about 45 minutes to an hour to get up there. He got down there in about 30, 35 minutes, and he was driving really fast. I remember looking over at him going, "Man, I don't want to survive the gunshot and die in a car wreck." So calm down a little bit. And walked into the emergency room, and they always ask you in the emergency room, can I help you? He said, "Yeah, absolutely, you can help me." So what's wrong? I said, "I've been shot." "You go right to the head of line. You go right to the head of line when you tell them that." And they were all working on me, and I had a cardiothoracic surgeon. And once they realized I wasn't going to die, then I was like the freak show. Everybody wanted to come by and see the X-ray with a bullet. I have it on my iPhone. It's pretty bizarre. It's right underneath. It's still there, underneath my sternum. And I was in the hospital for about 2.5 days, and I got discharged, and I had to see a cardiologist afterwards. And when I saw the cardiologist, they had run some tests on me, and I had this thing called an atrial flutter. And an atrial flutter is kind of like a low-grade atrial fibrillation. The cardiologists don't like it because what it means is that your heart is just trembling. It's quivering. They don't like that, And everything else seemed like it was okay but that. And he said, "Okay, but it's not a problem. We got this procedure we're going to do. It's called a cardioversion. And it's going to correct your irregular heartbeat." I'm like, "Okay, well, what are you going to do?" He said, "Well, you've seen the movies where they take the guys and they put the paddles on them and they shock. We don't have paddles. We just have these pads and we stick them on your chest and we shock you and we stop your heart and then we wait about 4 or 5 seconds and we start it back again to get in rhythm." Like, "You're going to kill me." And he's like, "Oh, no, we don't like to look at it that way, Mr. Lamb. And by the way, you're going to be in a hospital. It's going to be a very safe environment. There will be an anesthesiologist. The anesthesiologist will get you comfortable." Now I'm an alcoholic. I'm not happy about the cardioversion concept, but now I got an anesthesiologist. and he's going to get me comfortable. So I'm thinking, all right. Free ride. I mean, how comfortable am I going to get? You know, because I, you know, we were talking about Scott Redmond, and Scott used to talk about, you know, you get general anesthesia, and when you get general anesthesia, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you want to go 199. You know, I mean, you want the slow ride into it, right? And I'm thinking this is what's going to happen. So I'm laying there. They hook me up. They get the pads on me, and the anesthesiologist is talking to me. And the next thing I know, I'm talking to the cardiologist. It's happened. I'm like, what, I was supposed to get comfortable here. You know, I mean, what happened? It's like, oh, no, we gave you propofol, which is apparently what they gave to Michael Jackson. They didn't do that right. But with me, they did it right. And apparently, it just puts you out. You don't, there's no 99. It's just like you're talking to one guy, then you're talking to the next guy. It's very disappointing, frankly. It was, but the procedure worked. But the thing that's bizarre about this story, and this is an only an AA type of story, is I was on an AA retreat when I got shot. Oh, it gets better. It gets better. I was leading the retreat. I had given a talk the night before on Unity, and that night I was going to give a talk on acceptance and forgiveness. I kid you not. Really, I kid you not. But the best part is I was shot by a man I sponsor. You know, I will note for the recording that the Al-Anon is really getting a kick out of that. I still sponsor him. He's a great guy. He just made a mistake. We make mistakes. And I'm glad I'm here. And like I said, my sobriety date is July 27th, 1996. I've been consecutively sober since then. And if you're new, I'm sure you're really thrilled for me. It's just my story. It doesn't make me better than or less than. Looking back on it, I think I was probably more terrified than most people that come in, you know. But when I got here, I didn't want to be here. I came here on a court card. I had a DUI. I used to drive drunk all the time. I finally got popped for DUI. And the judge sentenced me to go to 6 AA meetings in 6 months. I thought that was unreasonable. And I didn't want to come. I didn't want to come. I didn't want to get sober. I didn't want to be sober. I thought it was a bad idea. I waited till I had about 5 weeks left to do 6 AA meetings. And because I'm new and I suffer from a delusion, I'm thinking, I got a busy social calendar. I don't know how. That's like more than one a week. I don't know how I could possibly fit that in. And in the greater Southern California area, there's probably, I don't know, 2,500, 3,000 meetings a week at the time. And finally I went on July 27, 1996. And the meeting I went to was not like this. It was a dark room with a brown floor, brown walls, brown ceiling, brown folded metal chairs, kind of creaky, you know, sagging in the seat and off to one side. And I walked in. I'd never been to an AA meeting before. And I walked in. I was a little late. And I walked in. And in that meeting, I went through these double doors. And to the left, there's a like a counter that they keep all the AA paraphernalia on that. The big book, the crap, you know, the stuff like the stuff that I don't want, the literature, the meeting, you know, the meeting guides, the meeting directory, all that stuff. And they do birthdays in the morning. And they were doing a birthday that morning. And I walked in, I sat down to my right. There's a coffee making machine. There's not supposed to be a chair there. There's normally a trash can there. But that morning there was a chair, my chair, separate and apart from you, as far away from you as I could get. I'm sitting here, you're sitting there, and they're sitting up, they're up here, they're standing here, and people, like, it'd be like a, you know, Joey's given Lee a cake for some godly period, years, and, you know, what she'd do is she didn't have a cake, an inverted styrofoam cup, you know, and she lights this candle like it's the Olympic torch. There's a hushed silence over the room, you know, and she marches it up, you know, up the aisle to Lee, who is, you know, waiting in anticipation. He's all excited, and, you know, everybody sings happy birthday, out of key, by the way, totally out of key. And then Lee blows out this monstrosity, a candle wax and, you know, molten styrofoam, and says, you know, thank you for the cake. And I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, I'm new. I'm like, that's not a cake. It's not even a pastry, you know. But he's all excited, and then he proceeds to tell everybody in the room things that we shouldn't talk about. I learned a lot. You don't talk about this stuff. And he's talking about it, and people are laughing and they're chuckling. But I am not laughing and chuckling. I am new. I don't want to be there. I have disdain for this thing that's going to save my life. I got my arms folded. You know, I'm looking at you, you're looking at me, and I'm giving you that, hey, back off, look, you know, don't bother me, I won't bother you. The reality is I'm terrified. I'm terrified. I'm terrified of you, I'm terrified of sobriety. I don't want to be there. And it was a participation meeting, they started sharing. I don't want to hear this crap, so I don't know about you, but when I'm out, I'm busy. You know, I'm a kind of guy, my wife sends me out to get milk, and I come back 3 days later. You know, I meet Jeremy, we start drinking beer, shooting tequila, and it's 3 days later. It's like time travel. It's amazing. And then, but I come back, and I'm like, I got the milk. I'm like, hey, baby, I got the milk. She's not impressed. You know, she's not impressed at all. I don't understand that there is a time limitation on the task, you know. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm you know, I'll just shut my eyes. I'll just take a nap, because I'm never coming back, and I don't want to waste, you know, I'm tired. Take a nap, and they're sharing, and they called on a guy named Dick Dolmage. And Dick died with 15 years of sobriety. He helped a lot of people, to include me. But I didn't much care for Dick or anybody else. And Dick was a retired fire captain. He was totally lit up for AA. And he was slightly deaf. And he wanted everybody to share in his enthusiasm. So he was rather loud that I don't know this and I'm new. And they call on Dick, and Dick goes, hi, I'm Dick, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, you know, if you're on the chunky side and you're in a folding metal chair that's canted off to one side, your butt starts sliding off the chair. I'm sliding off, trying to grab onto the coffee-making machine. I'm terrified, right? And you're all looking at me, and you're like, welcome to AA. And I'm like, screw you. You know, I don't want to be here. I don't like this at all. This is not cool. It's not funny. It's not, I don't know. You know, the meeting gets over, and we're going to get ready to leave, and somebody says we're going to pray. No problem. I've been to church. You know, I can do this. Stand up to pray, right? I stand up. And the next thing I know, the chucklehead to my left and my right, they grab my hands. Ooh, I mean, you know, but I don't want to make a scene, and I'm afraid. So now I'm holding hands with my two new friends. And we said a prayer. I don't know what the prayer was. I don't know if it was the Serenity Prayer, Lord's Prayer, Third Step, Seventh Step. We could have sung Kumbaya. I have no idea what it was. The prayer's over, and, you know, somebody said amen. I said amen. You know, I go to let go, you know, like catch and release, right? But I don't know what you do up here, but in Southern California, they don't do that. Next thing I know, I'm in this perverted daisy chain with 50, 60, 70 people, and my arms are rocking back and forth, you know, and they're all looking at me going, keep coming back. It works if you work it. And I am thinking, I have died and gone to Huckleberry Hill. I mean, I knew this was going to be bad, but you've exceeded my expectations. This is intolerable. I'm trying to get out. But there's some Nazi guy there. He's like the literature guy. He's like, oh, whoa, whoa. You got a big book? It's our program of recovery. It'll save your life. I'm like, I got a complex set of social issues. I don't think it's going to save my life. And by the way, it wasn't like this. It wasn't a big book. It was just a regular book. I'm like, that's not even a big book. A big book is like a coffee table book with pictures and stuff like that, you know? And he's all excited about this big book. He's like, do you want a meeting directory? No, I'm not coming back. How about a phone list? Like, I'm going to call you. That ain't going to happen. Another guy goes, hey, do you have a sponsor? I'm like, I don't even watch NASCAR, man. I'm out of here. I'm out of here. I'm not okay with this, right? And if you're new, I got to tell you, I was in that meeting almost every morning for a couple years. I would like to tell you that my journey of recovery started then, but I'm stubborn. I'm angry. And that's not my story. And you know, you heard the traditions tonight. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. You know, when we published the first big book, it said it was an honest desire to stop drinking. By the time we published the second edition and we put in the traditions, we dropped the honesty requirement. We knew what we were dealing with here, right? And because it happens gradually. And I'm going to meetings. And there are people telling me really meaningful things. They're saying, you know, meetings, meetings, meetings. Meeting makers make it. Just go to meetings, 90 meetings in 90 days. And I'm gone. There are other people that are talking about God, sponsorship, the big book, the program, which is the 12 steps, which is contained in the big book. But I don't want to overreact. You know, I'm not drinking here, you know. And I have a misimpression. I'm thinking I'm supposed to be getting better because I don't understand the first step. You know, I don't understand alcoholism. I think alcohol is my problem. So if I remove alcohol, I will get better. That's not happening for me. It's not even getting close to happening for me. I mean, I'm a jackass at home. I'm a jackass at work. I'm a jackass at the meetings. I come into the meetings. The old timers look at me. They go, hey, Lamb, just sit in the corner. Don't talk to anybody. And for God's sakes, don't talk to any newcomers because they still have hope. You know, it was ugly. It was ugly. And I went about 100 days, stark, raven sober. And And I went on a business trip. I'm a trial lawyer by trade. I went to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and then I went to Pittsburgh. I was doing some depositions getting ready for a trial, and I was supposed to be out all week. And I got done around Wednesday or Thursday. I can't remember the exact day, around noon. And I'm in Pittsburgh, and I went back to my hotel room. And inside my hotel room, I had an honor bar. An honor bar. I'm a newcomer. I have no honor. They've given me an honor bar. It's a little mini fridge. I've got the key. And inside the mini fridge, it's not everything I want, but it's a good start. You know, 2x2x2, there's bourbon, scotch, whiskey, gin. There was no tequila, which irritated me, but there's beer, domestics, import. And I want a drink. And I'm opening and shutting the honor bar, opening and shutting. I'm open, looking at it. And I want a drink. And what's happening is I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism. And I have what the 12 and 12 calls anxious apartness. It's this feeling of separation that every alcoholic I've ever worked with has. It's this belief that I'm just different. Not necessarily better than or worse than, but just different. And while this program of recovery has worked for hundreds and thousands and millions, it just won't work for me. It doesn't have an application for me because I'm different. I'm separate and apart. It's the grand illusion. It's the big delusion. I can only see through that once I've worked through the steps, but I don't know that because I'm new. I'm in the middle of the delusion. And I'm opening and shutting the honor bar, and I'm inventorying them, getting domestics import, getting it arranged, getting it ready. And now I'm scared, so I'm trying to distract myself. I start watching television. I start flipping channels, religious television, porno, religious television, porno. I didn't say it was you too, huh, sir? And I didn't say it was a good plan, and I'm getting confused as to who's doing what on what channel, but that's a personal problem. And one of the things that, I mean, I love the big book and I love the 12 and 12, but when I was new and I finally got a sponsor, my sponsor had me listen to a series of talks by a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. And he did these talks in 75 or 76, Lee probably knows, and down in Palo Mesa, and they put it in a book. And in the book, there's a drawing. It's a simple drawing. So there's only one drawing in the whole book. And what Chuck does is he draws this circle. And inside the circle, it's a circle of life. He puts all the people, plants, animals, everything in the universe inside the circle of life. And he puts life, good, God, whatever your concept of higher power is, in that circle of life. But then outside the circle, on the left-hand side, he draws a stick man. And that's Chuck, and that's me. And if you're an alcoholic of my variety, it's you. Separated outside the circle of life. And what separates us is a thin line that Chuck identifies as ego, or conscious separation from God. By the 11th step, we're striving for conscious contact, but here I have conscious separation, and I'm just out of my mind. But for whatever reason, whether it's the dumb luck of the alcoholic, and Norm Alpe used to call it seconds and inches, I now call it the grace of God, but I didn't refer to it that way for a long time. I don't drink. I go downstairs, I get in the car, I go out to the airport, I fly home. I get up the next morning, and on the flight home, I've had a lot of time to think. I'm a newcomer, I've developed a newcomer plan. And it's a brilliant plan. It is. And it goes like this. When I was in the Army, I went through airborne school and ranger school. I went through special forces training. I was in 10th group for a while. They sent me over to Beirut. They eventually sent me to law school. And by the time I got out, I'd done 13 and a half years, and I'd acquired some things. I got out in 1993, and I'd kept a kit bag, and I had some weapons and some demo and 13 passports in it. And I didn't think about it as stealing at the time. I mean, I just thought, this could come in handy one day. You know, I mean, I might need this. And today's the day. And I'm not going to go Columbine with the weapons or the demo, and I've since gotten rid of everything, but I need the passports. I need the passports because my plan is this. I'm going to take my blue tourist passport that was legitimately issued to me by the United States government. It has my name on it, Steve Lamb. I'm going to fly to British Columbia. When I get to British Columbia, I'm going to start flipping passports and identities. I'm going to head east. I'm going to go over to Europe, spend a week or two there. I'm going to come back to British Columbia. Steve Lamb will cease to exist. Now I got a wife, I got a kid, but they're not part of the equation. It's just a career move, and they're not involved. I don't want to bother them about this change, right? And when I get to British Columbia, I'm going to head down to Costa Rica, because I've got some former Army associates of mine. They're doing some kind of interesting marketing and distribution down there. And that's my newcomer plan. So I lay all this stuff out, and the 13 passports I should have turned in 1993, they are all current. They have not expired. But my blue tourist passport has expired. And I'm just beside myself because I can't execute this brilliant plan. And, I mean, I'm relatively well-educated. The Army sent me to law school at University of Southern California. They sent me back next to the University of Virginia at the JAG School for an LLM, a Master of Laws, year program. I'm licensed to practice before the Supreme Court of the United States. But in 1996, as I'm sitting there on the floor of my house, I don't have the cranial capacity, the synaptic ability. My brain doesn't work sufficiently to realize, again, this is pre-9/11, I could have flown to British Columbia on my driver's license. You didn't need a passport back then to go to Canada. But I can't figure that out. I'm just beside myself, and I don't know what to do. I'm almost in tears. So I went to a meeting. And I'm at this meeting in the morning, and I met a guy who became my grand sponsor, Jim Nisbet. He also died with 15 years of sobriety. Did not like Jim. Did not like Jim at all. No. Jim was, all he talked about was God, the big book, the steps, and sponsorship in no particular order. That's all he talked about. I did not like him. And he was talking about sponsorship that morning. And I found out later this isn't exactly what he said, but what I heard is if you don't get a sponsor, you're going to die. And I felt like I'd done everything. I hadn't done anything, but I felt like I'd done everything. So I went up to Jim after the meeting, and I looked at him in the shoes because I couldn't really look at him in the face. And I said, Jim, I heard you talking about sponsorship, and I've been sober for about 100 days. I think it's about time that I interview for a sponsor. Because in my mind, people have been saying, find someone who has what you want. Now, how can you do that if you don't interview them? I got a complex set of social issues. I mean, it's not just anybody can sponsor me, right? But Jim looks at me and he grabs me by the shoulder. He goes, man, you are pathetic. And he takes me outside and he introduces me to a guy I've never met before. He says, Michael, Steve, Michael, sponsee, go with God. And he walks away laughing. And I'm thinking, this is not funny. It's not even slightly amusing. I don't even know this guy. And for a long time, I thought Jim was trying to help me. I now realize, because I've got a little time in this program, he was really thinking about Michael. I didn't realize it at the time, but he sponsored Michael. Michael was struggling. He needed a new guy. That's what we do. We push the new guys to people. You know, and if you're new, you realize we have a vampiric need for newcomers. It's at times, it's a little bit unseemly. We'll talk all this spiritual crap, but if you're the only newcomer in a room and there's four or five of us, you might see some hip chucking and fighting over you to get, we do that, you know? But Michael's got me. I'm a captive audience. I'm standing there. I'm like a deer in the headlights. And he reaches in his pocket. He gets out a piece of paper and his pen. And he writes his name and his address. And he asks me a few questions I like to ask the people I sponsor. He says, do you have a big book? Now, I'm looking at this guy. And I'm not saying this, but I'm thinking, yeah, I'm not reading with you. I don't even know you. I don't know you. You're younger than me. I don't know. I've got a complex set of social issues. But I said, yeah, I got a big book. He says, do you have a 12 and 12? And again, I'm not saying this, but I'm looking. I'm going, yeah, I got a 12. I'm not reading with you. And by the way, he's got a lazy wandering eye. Shifts off to the right. You know, it's just, it's creepy. When we did sexual misconduct inventory, he said, you know, before we do this, we're going to invite God into the room. And he looked up and to the right. And I followed him. I don't know. It could be up there. I don't. And I'm looking at this guy, and I got a 12 and 12. And he says, good, you're going to need them both. Be at my house Monday night at 6:30. And everything in my body said no. But somewhere deep inside me, I said, okay. And before I could reconsider, he just, because he knew what he was dealing with, he just turned around and left. You know, now I'm hooked. And what happened was I would meet with this guy every Monday night, and we would read the big book in the 12 and 12. He would have me read ahead. He didn't trust me. I would have to then read with him. He would ask me questions. He'd ask me definitions. If I knew the definition, I'm a lawyer. I know words, but apparently I don't, actually. I had to look a lot of stuff up. I thought I knew, but I didn't know. And we got to a step. We worked the step. We got to a tradition. We worked through the traditions. And we got to a prayer. We said the prayer. We just went through the book. And with the 12 and 12. And it worked. And then there's people that will come up here at the podium and they'll say Alcoholics Anonymous for people that want it. Others will come up and argue, say no, Alcoholics Anonymous for people who really need it. You know, my experience is it's for people who do it. It's for people that do it. Attitude is optional. I had a crappy attitude. I now love Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't love it then. And for the new people, I don't like to spend a lot of time on this, but just to give you an idea what my drinking was like towards the end. Like I said, I'm a trial lawyer by trade. So when I prepare for trial before I got sober, the way I did that was I would drink beer and shoot tequila. That's how I prepared for trial. I would get the case file out. I would not open it. I wouldn't look at anything. I would just put it on the conference room table. I'd kind of lay it there or take it in my bedroom and I'd lay it there. And I'd start drinking beer and shooting tequila. And beer is like a food group and tequila is like an accelerant. Okay? And what would happen is, in my mind's eye, it was just unbelievable. I would drink beer and shoot tequila, and the courtroom would unfold in my mind's eye. I would make an opening statement. I would have picked a jury. I would examine witnesses. I would cross-examine witnesses. All the evidence I wanted in would get in. The evidence I wanted excluded would be excluded. I would make a brilliant closing argument. The jury would go back. They would retire. They would review the facts and the arguments in the case, and they would come back and return a verdict in my favor, all while drinking beer and shooting tequila. It was just like magic. Now, the problem with this process is that when you drink the way I do, you drink and you know, until boom, you're out, you know, and sometimes it's not even before the jury comes back. You know, I'm I could be in the middle of my closing argument, and I'm just down, and I know this happens, and I black out. I'm out, but I'm prepared for this. I know how this works, so I set usually 4 or 5 alarm clocks at 2 to 3 minute intervals throughout the room, because 1 or 2 won't wake me up. And by the next morning, around the 3rd or 4th alarm clock, I wake up, I stagger around, I turn them all off, I go, I shower, I shave, I put on a suit and tie, and I go to court. And the particular morning that I'm thinking about, I'm in Los Angeles Superior Court. My client's a guy named Brian. He's from New York. He's a high finance guy. And this is a case about other people's money. It's a commercial case. And we've been trying to resolve it for a while, but the two parties won't agree. So I'm there, and we're picking a jury. And the judge is telling my client and the other client, look, you know, if you can, keep talking about settlement, because it's a commercial matter. It's just money. And, you know, you're going to tie up my courtroom for weeks. And, you know, if you can settle this, I'd really appreciate it if you try to settle it. So me and the other lawyer are picking a jury. But around 11:30, Brian comes to us and he says to the judge, he's all excited. He says, we've reached the settlement. Now the judge is happy. My client is happy. It's several million dollars in his favor. The judge puts it on a record. He's really pleased with us. And he releases us before noon. And Brian looks at me and he's really excited. He goes, man, this is great. I mean, you know, we should celebrate. I know it's early, it's before noon, but would you like a drink? I'm thinking, yeah, I would totally like a drink. I mean, you know, I was thinking I wasn't going to be able to drink till I got out of trial, but now it's, you know, it's not even noon, I'm going to drink, and you're going to pay? That's great. So we went to the Grand Avenue Bar, which is on Grand Avenue and 5th in downtown LA. It's right next to the Biltmore Hotel. It's kind of a high-end sports bar. Now, I drink a lot at home, and I'll go to bars, but the bars that I usually go to are not classy bars like this. They usually have a little sawdust on the floor and kind of a faint eau de urine scent that just is exciting to me for some reason. I'm not sure why. And this bar is like a polished mahogany counter bar. And Brian goes up to the bartender and he has the bartender get a bottle of cognac back from the back. And it's kind of dusty and he puts it on the counter and he has us pour 2 shots for us. And the bartender takes out 2 large brandy snifters and he plops them down and he pours 1 fluid ounce in each brandy snifter. Now, when you pour an ounce of tequila in a shot glass, you can see it. It's really, it's right there. And in fact, if you're a good bartender, it's so full I gotta lean over and, you know, because you don't want to spill any of the nectar of the gods, right? But when you put a fluid ounce into this large goblet brandy snifter, you can hardly see it. It's sad and lonely and desperate. And, you know, I'm looking over at it, and because I know it went in there, but I can't, you know, and there's this kind of amber shimmer that comes off the glass. But, and Brian looks at me and he says, you've never had cognac before. I'm like, no. I mean, he's buying, I'm not stupid, but I've never had cognac. He says, okay, look, there's a whole process. There's a protocol to this. I want you to pay attention. This is how you do this. You want to take the brandy snifter. You want to cup it in the base of the palm of your hand. And so the palm of your hand makes contact with the glass. The heat from the palm of your hand will go through the brandy snifter, and it will warm up the cognac, and that will release the bouquet. Now, I'm thinking this is totally unnecessary with tequila, you know. But he says, then once that's happened, you want to twirl it around and coat the glass, and you bring it up to your nose. Don't snort it. Don't sniff it. Just allow the bouquet to waft into your nostrils to really appreciate it. Then you want to back it down, and, you know, when it's the right... You really get the scent, you know, you really appreciate the book. You want to bring it up to your lips. Don't drink it. Don't sip it. Just allow the cognac to drape across your palate. I'm thinking, we're going to drink this stuff, right? You know, and he says, then after, you know, that's so look, watch me, I'll show you. And he's like, the guy's right out of GQ. He's really elegant, and he does the whole thing, and he does it, and he puts it, and he says, okay, Lamb, it's your turn. I'm like, my turn. I love my turn. I'm ready. I'm going to turn. And so I twirl it around, right? And, you know, I mean, how warm does it need to get, right? You know? So I'm bringing it up because I'm going to let it waft, and bam, I just shoot it like tequila, you know? And it's gone. And I looked at Brian, and Brian looked at me. I don't know who was more surprised. And he says, He says, man, what are you doing? That's like a couple hundred dollars a shot. So I just reverted to the alcoholic anthem. I just looked down and said, I'm sorry. Can I have a beer? And he was like, yeah, he's a pretty cool guy. So I'm drinking beer. I have two or three beers, you know. I'm not where I was last night, but I'm getting warmed up. And Brian's a real generous. He's a magnanimous guy. He goes, okay, pay attention. We're going to do it again. I'm like, I can do this, you know. And he goes through the whole process. I watch him, and now I'm ready. And I bam, and it's gone again, you know. And he looks at me. He gives me that look like, hey, man, that ain't right. You know, that's not right, you know. And because he knows, he's never read the big book, but he knows that I am bodily and mentally different than he is. And he gives me this kind of funny look. He goes, wow, okay. I'll tell you what, it's a little before one. It's almost 4 o'clock back in New York. So I'm gonna go to the bathroom, and then I'm gonna come back, and I'm gonna go to the hotel and call him and tell him the good news. And I'm gonna take off. It's all right, no problem. So I'm sitting there minding my own business, drinking my beer, right? And I look over and I see his cognac. Bam! You know, I drink that. I go to the bathroom, I come back out, and now Brian's arguing with the bartender because somebody stole his cognac. It's very expensive. I remind him, I am a trial attorney. I'm an expert in cross-examination. I'm going around to people. I'm cross-examining them. But Brian is not stupid. He's not stupid. He's what we now call about to be an ex-client. You know, he just kind of shakes his head and goes, man, I'm leaving. Now, a normal person would be pretty upset. At the time, I worked for a large international law firm. This is a pretty big client. You know, the case was successful, but this client is he an ex-client? He's not happy. And when I go back, I've got some explaining to do. It's going to be ugly. But I'm an alcoholic, and I'm thinking, man, now we're going to get to it. Now I'm going to drink the way I want to. So I get to a table, I start drinking beer, shooting tequila, drink beer, shooting tequila. And, you know, a lot of people, when they drink, they forget to do a lot of things. They forget to bathe, they forget to eat. I'm not that guy. I like a light snack, maybe a pizza or a couple cheeseburgers, nothing too heavy. You know, and I'm drinking beer, shooting tequila, I've had like a pizza, and you know, I suffer from delusions, you know, so I'm sitting there, and it's not a particularly special skill set, but I start farting. And I don't know what's up with this, but for some reason, I got this whole purple haze thing going. I'm thinking I'm making music, right? And everybody's looking at me like they're disgusted. There's a couple women off in the corner, and they're looking at me. But I'm delusional. I'm thinking, oh, yeah, they want me. I mean, who wouldn't? You know, I probably coughed up a chunk of pizza, but I'm just out of my mind. I'm sitting there. I'm drinking beer and shooting tequila, and I'm ripping them off, you know, and... And I go to be particularly musical, and I miscalculate. Now, the bad thing is I've done this before, you know, and memory's elastic, you know, it'll almost snap you back to sober, but not quite. And so I will tell you, if you go back out and you do this, it's really important. You got to keep things in mind. First of all, you want to act cool, okay? And the other thing is you got to keep that cheek cocked. You don't want to make contact again. You know, you got to keep that cheek cocked, and then you want to just kind of finish your beer and just kind of slide off on one cheek. Just slide off on one cheek and just kind of mosey to the bathroom. You know, I go to the bathroom, and I get in the stall, I take off my jacket, I take off my pants, and I take off my drawers, and I clean myself up. I put my pants back on, put my jacket back on. I'm out of the sink like every good American, and I'm rinsing my drawers out in the sink. A guy came and looked just faced just like that, man. Just, you know, and I'm like, hey, you know, what's your problem? Don't you practice hygiene? I mean, come on, you know. And I get them wrung out. I go back in the stall, and I take my jacket and my pants off. I put my drawers back on because I got some class, right? And I put my pants back on. I put my jacket back on. I'm walking out, and, you know, they're kind of damp. And because I suffer from delusions, I'm thinking, I'm feeling kind of sexy here, you know. I mean, this is just, I'm out of my mind. And then, you know, finally they kick me out, and I drive home. And I park in the driveway. My driveway, your driveway. I'm an equal opportunity driveway kind of guy. I don't care which driveway it is. And what happened? I got to go through the front door. Now, the front door is a double wide garage door. There's no way I'm getting a key in the keyhole. So I don't put the car in there. I just put it up, and I stagger through there. And there's a door that goes into the living room. To the right, there's a fridge. And in the fridge, there's beer. I don't care if I've been out for 3 hours or 3 days. I get a beer. I drink. I drink. That's what I do. I drink a beer on the way upstairs, and maybe I put it on the floor. I might put it on the nightstand. I crawl into bed next to my lovely wife, and on a on a good night, in a few hours, I get up, I stagger around, I wind up in the closet, I pee in a trash can, or I pee in her boots, and on a bad night, I wet the bed. Oh yeah, it was a vision for you when I got here. That's, that's what I bring to the party. And that wasn't a ridiculous price to pay. It seemed to inconvenience you. You weren't thrilled with it. My wife was really not thrilled with it. But I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I don't care. I just want to do what I want to do when I want to do it. And so now I'm not drinking, and I got this sponsor. I'm meeting with him every Monday night. And I want to talk about a couple of steps. I want to talk about inventory for a while, because I've been dealing with a lot of people and some people that I've got that have been passed on from other people. And sometimes there's an impression that inventory is really complicated in alcoholics. And my experience is that's not the case. Now, I will tell you this. I really suggest that you do whatever your sponsor has you do. There's all kinds of guidebooks and ways to do inventory, but it's not complicated. And my sponsor knew, I'm a wordsmith. I'm kind of a pain in the butt, sponsee. So my sponsor wanted me to keep it really simple. He wanted me to do it the way it's in the book. He took me to page 65. He said, and if you don't know, that's the one that the three columns are on. And he says, do you notice anything about these columns? I don't know, no, not really. He goes, well, look again. I said, okay, well, I mean, that Mr. Brown's kind of a jackass. I mean, he's tightening him up. But I mean, he goes, no. You'll notice that there's not even complete sentences there. I mean, people are talking sometimes about inventory like a life story. And that's, I'm prepared for a long talk. I'll listen to whatever you read to me. But I really would appreciate it if you try to follow the outline in the book. And in your case, for each column, you only need 2 to 3 words. 2 to 3 words. I want you to identify the person, the institution, or the principle that you're resentful at. I want you to list the cause. 2 to 3 words. I want you to list how it affects you or what the condition is. You know, self-esteem, pocketbook, security, ambition, personal relations, sex relations. And then on 67, I would like another column. It's a fourth column. It's not in the book, but it talks about turning back to our list. We're going to list mistakes, fault, or blame. And he pointed out to me, he says, I'm not talking about your part. And that's a lot of people talk about your part. That's a perfectly good shorthand. But in your case, I don't want you to think about it that way, because there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous that think about their part, and they get to the fourth column and they think they have to have a part in the cause. And maybe they're a woman that's been raped or a child that's been abused, and they don't have a part there. They always have a part, a mistake, fault, or blame, in the condition, but not necessarily in the cause. I don't know what he's talking about, but I'm trying to follow instructions. He then gives me the instructions on the fear inventory, the sexual misconduct inventory. He tells me, it should take me about a couple weeks. I think it took me about 5 or 6 weeks. And it took me 5 or 6 weeks because it took me 5 or 6 weeks to do about 2 weeks worth of work. The reality is, as the book says, it's simple but not easy. The simple part is the black part, the instructions. The not easy part is me and my ego, which constantly strives to separate me from you and me from God. And it'll kill you if you let it. So I do this inventory and I get ready to read it to him. And for the new people, I'm going to tell you the first person in my inventory, because it's really easy. It's really simple. I'll never forget it. I'm reading my inventory to Michael. I'm doing my fifth step. And I tell him the first person in my inventory is a person I'm resentful at. 2 words. My father. The cause, 2 words, deserted me. Now, he's prepared for a long talk. And I explained to him that I was about 4 or 5 years old. My dad was in the Air Force. He left. He went to Vietnam. He did not die there. He just went to Vietnam. He stayed there for a few years. He joined an outfit called Air America. He stayed there for more time. He was there, I think, a total of about 8 or 10 years. He met a Thai woman. He married her, apparently before he divorced my mom. So I have a stepmother and I've got a half-sister, Peck, that I've never met. And I hardly hear from my dad. I've hardly heard from him in, a little over 3 decades. What does it affect? Everything. Self-esteem, pocketbook, security, ambition, personal relations, sex relations. It's a five-bagger, and then my whole life is shot through with it. I mean, other than that, everything's going well, but yeah, just pretty much everything. And then what's my mistake, fault, or blame? Well, I don't have mistake, fault, or blame in relation to the cause. What about the condition? I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm 37 years old. By the time I'm writing this inventory, I'm 38 years old. I've had this resentment for over 3 decades. And resentments are the number one offender. They're the cause of all spiritual disease. And they'll kill me. I have to get rid of it. What defect of character do I have that if God were to remove it, I would no longer have this resentment? Am I selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, dishonest? I don't think so. How about the 7 deadly sins? Pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth. I write down anger.
I was really angry for a long time. Now it's just kind of a dull, I hate the SOB, but definitely anger applies. I write down anger. Fear. Yeah, I write down fear because I have a lot of fear. What does the fear look like? I love my father. I love my father. And in my mind, at the age of 4 or 5, that love was a transmission from me to him of a certain power over me. And he abused that power. And I can never, ever let that happen again. There has to be a wall of insulation between me and you and me to protect me from you because it's not safe. You can't know me for who I am. The part in the big book that talks about being the actor, I love that. I'm totally the actor. I don't want you to know who I am because if you know who I really am, you can hurt me. I don't want that to happen. Now, that does not make it for good marital relations or relations with the kids or friends or co-workers or anybody, but it's all I got. And finally, I'm unwilling to accept that my father's a child of God who could be spiritually sick like me, as it says on the bottom of 66 and 67. I'm unwilling to forgive him. I read this to Michael, and I'm ready. I'm going to move on to the next person. And Michael says, I don't realize this is an iterative process. I'm going to do my entire life in Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, whoa. I've got some questions. I'm like, okay, what are they? He says, if I understand you correctly, you resent your father, right? Yeah. He deserted you. Yeah, he did. And you have some residual anger. A lot of fear, and you don't want to forgive him. And I'm like, yeah, Michael, and I've read ahead. I know there's a ninth step. It's never going to happen. Ever. And he says, well, look, this is a program of willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness, but we're just in the process of reading here. You know, we're going to, just so you know, we're going to get to that later. But I have one more question I'd like to ask you. I said, sure, what is it? He said, well, if I understand you correctly, when you came to me and, you know, I told you something about me and you told me about you and you had told me that you had this plan that morning. You asked me to sponsor you that, you know, you were going to take these passports and you were going to go to British Columbia and then you were going to go to Costa Rica and you had a wife and a kid and you were leaving. You weren't going to take them with you. And I don't think you said that you were going to desert them, but what's the difference between what you were planning on doing and what your father did? Well, my first thought was, this is not going the way I thought it was going to go at all. Not good. And then I hung my head and I muttered something like, well, I mean, if you look at it that way. And if you're new, that's one of the reasons why we do the fifth step the way we do. We admit to ourselves, to God, and to another person, because I need that other person, in this case my sponsor, to hold a mirror up to me, to reflect me back to me, so I can see me for who I am. Because I can't see me for who I am. I can't see that. And you know, he asked me some questions. Do you think you're any better than your father? I said, no, I don't. Thanks for pointing that out to me. And we finished the rest of the inventory. I did the fear inventory, did the sexual misconduct inventory. I went home, I got quiet. I reviewed what I'd done. I thought I was relatively thorough. I realized later I wasn't. I did 6 and 7 the best I could. And 6 is a lot about willingness and 7 is a lot about honesty. I had very little of either. They mean a lot more to me now than they did then. But I was just trying to move through the motions. Now I got to write an 8-step list of proposed amends. I got to show it to my sponsor. And I do this and I read them to him. And he's looking at him and he says, oh, your father's not on the list. I'm like, you're damn Skippy. He's not. I told you he wasn't going to be on the list. He says, well, look, I mean, you know, I mean, many AA meetings we close with the Lord's Prayer, right? I said, yeah. Because, you know, there's a clause in the Lord's Prayer. It says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. But what do you think that means? I'm like, I think it's a damn trick question. That's what I think. I mean, you know, because it's a spiritual truth. It's an axiom. I'm only forgiven to the extent that I forgive. So I can understand it intellectually, but he says, well, are you willing to make a man? No. He says, well, okay, look. The 8th step is a lot about willingness, too. Are you willing to pray for the willingness? I'm like, yeah. I say, okay, I'll pray, you'll pray, we'll both pray. And now I start making amends. And I make amends to the wife, I make amends to my wife. I'm back in the big bed. I don't quite have the crossover privileges that I think I deserve, but that's, you know. And I go pay back some money. I make some amends work-wise, and I make amends to my daughter. And one of the biggest amends I made was to my daughter. My daughter Ashley was born with cerebral palsy and seizure disorder. And can't walk, can't talk, eats through a feeding tube. A lot of medications for seizures. And one of the many things I'm not proud of, but it's true, is I resented my daughter, both before I got sober and for a while after I got sober. And, you know, I'm not even sure what that was about. I mean, she wasn't normal. I had to take care of her rather than I got the opportunity to. I don't know what it, but I know enough that a father's not supposed to feel this way about a daughter. And so I'm doing a lot of inventory, and I'm praying and meditating. I'm in a process now where I've got an active 10-step and an active 11-step. I'm praying and meditating every morning. I'm trying to get conscious contact with this God that I don't really understand. And I'm trying to practice the principles in all my affairs. And one of the guys that helped me a lot on this, we were talking, Scott Redman, helped me a lot on this. And finally I got to the point where I made amends to my daughter. It was great. I mean, a father was restored to a daughter and a daughter to a father, and that was AA. And we used to go down, and she was at San Diego at the time in a 24-hour care facility because she would have anywhere between 10 and 100 tonic-clonic seizures every day, little jerky seizures. But once every few weeks or a month or so, she'd have a grand mal seizure, and it'd be system shutdown. You know, and then I'd have to wheel her over and paddle her, and she'd be in ICU for a while. But she was a tough kid. She always kind of bounced back. But she needed to be in that facility. And we would go down and visit her. And while they still had Shamu, we would take her to SeaWorld. She'd be in a wheelchair. We'd tie a little balloon around her chair. And the wind would rustle through her hair, and it'd blow the balloon. She'd laugh and giggle. And it was great. It was great. But I'm not making amends to my father. Yeah. And now guys are starting to ask me to sponsor them. And the first guy that asked me to sponsor him was a guy named Stephen. And Stephen had a son, and his son was named Evan. And Evan had a cerebral palsy with a seizure disorder. And he resented Evan. What are the chances of that? So I'm praying and meditating a lot, and I'm starting to believe that this God thing might have some merit. And I'm working with Stephen, and he goes through the steps, and you know, the father's restored to a son, and the son to a father, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything's great. But I'm still not making amends to my father. And then I get another four guys in a row, and they all get a year. They all go through the steps. And now I get a little spiritual pride. I'm thinking, you know, obviously I'm supposed to be doing this stuff. I know what I'm doing. Shoot, I'm a man of God, you know, and they're all coming to me. And then Stephen goes out. And to show you how non-spiritual I am, the first thought I have is, man, this son of a bitch is making me look bad. Yeah. And I tried to get him back, and then old timer said, you got to wait. And he came back, and he now has 11 years, but it took 5 years for him to come back. And I would start working with guys, and I couldn't get him through Bill's story. I couldn't get him to call me back. And I would go to my sponsor. I'd say, what am I doing wrong? I must be doing something wrong. He says, well, you might have a little, you know, pride issue, but you ought to look at that. And then he said to me, he said, you were the first. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, you know, I had 5 years when you came to me, and you were the first guy that got a year. We don't work with these people to get them sober, necessarily. We work with these people because we work with these people. We do the work because this is what we do. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, and he told me, you know, even Lee talks about it. With Bill, he complained to Lois. You know, he was working with all these guys his first 6 months, and nobody was staying sober, and he was complaining. And he complained to Lois, his wife, and his wife said, well, you have. Oh, missed that. So then I made a mistake. After a few years, I told my sponsor that I was going up to Anchorage, Alaska to do some depositions. And he immediately got all excited. Man, that's great. You'll make amends to your father. And I had forgotten that I told him that my father lives in Wasilla, Alaska, which is just outside of Anchorage. So I'm like, whoa. You're connecting two unrelated dots. I'm just going to go do a deposition. I mean, he goes, no. You're praying. I'm praying. We're praying. God's talking. Can you hear him? I'm like, no, I did not get the memo. You know, I don't know. I'm not, you know, And the bottom line is I went up and made amends to my father. I didn't want to go. I was kind of nervous about it. And I walked up, and I'd asked Michael what I should do, and he wouldn't tell me. He wouldn't give me direction. You know, he told me to talk to God. He used to irritate the hell out of me. I used to call him the cosmic cupcake, the mystic muffin. You know, he was just, it was God. And I went through the airport, and I saw my father in the distance, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and you know, he was older than I thought he was going to be. He was shorter than I thought he was going to be. He was kind of shuffling towards me. He was uncertain, and I just walked up to him. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what I'm going to say. I've been asking God for direction. I'm getting nothing, but I somehow feel it'll be okay. I've made a commitment. I'm going to do this. I got up in front of my father, and I did one of the things that I absolutely hated when I first got here. I hugged him, and I hated all physical contact when I first got here. And I hugged my father, and my father buried his head in my shoulder, and he cried. And I cried, that forgiveness occurred, and all I had to do was show up and get out of the way. Show up and get out of the way. And now I have a pretty decent relationship with my father. Is it perfect? No. No, but it's okay. And more importantly, you know, when I talk about my dad, I don't get this pit of, you know, acid in my stomach. You know, it's okay. It's okay. And then my daughter died. You know, we got a call. We went down, and she was in ICU, and I'm talking to her. I combed her hair, and I patted her hand, and the doctors called us off to the side, and they told us they need to talk to us. Ashley's not going to make it out of the hospital. What are you talking about? And he explained. He said, "Look, she's 19, but she's 80 or 90 internally. You know, it's kind of like the people that use a lot of drugs and alcohol. You know, their internal system, because she was on so much medication, her liver, her kidneys, they were just shut. They were done. They couldn't process it anymore. It was system shutdown. And she was going through renal failure, and I was mad. And like I said, I had an active 11-step process, so I'm praying and meditating. I'm talking. Yeah, I'm yelling at God. I'm mad. I'm saying, you know, God, how could you do this to me? I know I was a bad father, but I'm a good father now. How could you take my daughter from me? And I did do a lot of work on this. I'd do a lot of inventory. I'd do a lot of prayer and meditation. And what came to me is I realized that, you know, I was being selfish and self-centered. My daughter could never talk, but when I held her and cradled her in my arms, she looked at me and she could talk with her eyes, and she was okay. She was ready to go. She was in a lot of pain. My job is to be her father in this world or the next, and to help her make that transition. I was able to do that through Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I've come to believe through that process that we're not just this physical being. We're not a bag of bones and skin and tissue and muscle. There's something else. There's something else. I don't care what you call it. You know, soul, spirit. The religious call it the golden cord, the silver thread. My friend Scott called it the connective tissue, that which binds me to you and you to me. And it's what happens when I do a fifth step with a man, and I realize that distance that I think exists between me and him and us and God is nowhere. There is no distance. There's a connection. And I believe this because I believe my daughter taught me a lot about love. And my job is to pass that on. I learned a lot from Scott Redmond. I learned a lot from people like Sandy Beach. And they are no longer physically here, but they're not gone. Bill Wilson's not gone. These old-timers in your area that have passed down wisdom through you, your job is to pass that on to the new person. And, you know, I've been doing this for a while now, and one of the last things I want to talk about is, because I want you to be clear that I'm not an authority in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't appointed or anointed. I'm just a guy that was asked to come up and share his experience. Alcoholics Anonymous is experiential. You have your experience. That's what you're here for. Not my experience, not your sponsor's experience. Your experience. And the steps are a set of spiritual exercises. And they're designed to allow each individual to find, develop, and maintain a conscious contact with God, his or her understanding, based on the work that you do. And I mean, my sponsor one time told me there's good news and bad news. And I'm like, what's the bad news? You know, the bad news is it never ends. Never ends. I'm like, well, what's the good news? He said, well, the good news is there's always something to do and somebody to do it with. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. And the last thing I want to talk about is to give you an example of how this is recurring through my life. And how when I read in the chapter 5 that we are not saints, I totally embrace that concept. One of the biggest resentments I had was against my wife. It's stupid, it's ridiculous, but I'll tell you, it was huge to me. I had a couple years, and like I said, I'm taking guys through the book. I'm a man of God, you know, and she does not appreciate all the hard work that I have done for us. I know this because she takes the trash and recycling and she puts it on the stoop every night. Yeah, and what that means is I'm back in the big bed, but you know, I'm just the trash recycling guy. So I'm taking it out to the bins. I'm just pissed. I throw it in the bins. I don't talk to her about it. I just throw it in the bins. I write inventory. And I read it to Michael. And Michael says, well, have you talked to her about it? Well, no, I haven't talked to her about it. Well, you could. You know, you might be a mistake. Well, no, you know, Michael, I know. I've been married now 32 years. At the time, it was like 13, 14 years. And, you know, and I tell him, I said, you know, I know what she's thinking before she's thinking. And he goes, well, you know, we call that mind reading, which is a pretty significant character defect. But, but I was convinced. And he said, well, look, you know, it's a resentment. You're going to have to deal with it. You have to talk to God. You're going to have this removed. So you're going to have to pray and meditate. So I'm praying and meditating. I'm writing inventory. I'm just killing small forests. I'm taking out trash. I'm just pissed. I'm praying and meditating. And this takes, this takes like 8 or 9 months. There's hope for the newcomer. But I finally get the answer. And the answer is patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. We hear it in all of me. It's in the book. It's all over the place. It's not rocket science, but it takes me 8 or 9 months to come up with that. So I pray for it and I get it. Now I got the trash recycling and it's no problem. I've got patience and tolerance, love and understanding. I'm taking out no problem. I twitch a little bit, but I'm not writing any more inventory. I'm okay. And now I'm telling all the guys that I work with that I've worked through this big character defect. I tell them what I've done because I want to share with them. I'm proud, right? This goes on for over a decade. We finally get a dog. Dog's named Zoe. She's a golden retriever. She does what dogs do. I take her out in the morning. She does her business. I put it in a bag. I throw it in the trash. Nights like tonight, I go to a meeting. My dog will go in the backyard and she'll poop. My wife will go back there and she'll put it in a bag, but does she put it in the trash? She puts it with the trash and recycling on the stoop for me. So, I go out in the morning and I'm a spiritual guy and all this stuff, right? But now I got trash recycling and poop. I know what this means. I got poop, Michael. I got poop. She left poop in the bag. He's like, well, have you talked to her about it? Well, no, I haven't talked to her about it. We go through the same whole process. I have to pray and meditate. I ask God for direction. I get the same answer. This only takes a couple weeks. It's patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. I pray for it again. No problem. I'm good. This goes on for a few years. About 3 years ago, I went out the front door instead of the side door. I did not get the trash, recycling, and poop. I got to make amends. I'm going ready to go to my men's stag. This is my home group. Hermosa Beach men's stag. And I'm like, before I go to the stag, I got to make amends. So I'm having dinner with the wife and the kids. And, I wait for the right time and say, hey, Lynn. My wife's name, Lynn. I'm sure you probably noticed this morning. I went to the front door instead of the side door. I did not get the trash and recycling and poop. I know that's my job. Try to do better. I apologize. She's like, what? Apparently, you have to talk slowly. Okay, no problem. I'm pause when agitated. I've been taught that trick. Okay, baby, the trash, recycling, and poop. I wouldn't have been doing it for over a decade, it's my job, and I know I haven't, and I didn't do it this morning, and I apologize. She's like, what are you talking about? So now my head's doing like a rotisserie, okay? But I slow down. I say it really, really slowly, and she looks at me and lovingly says, Steve, we have possums, and we have skunks out in the back there. Now we have these coyotes are coming down from the hill in Palos Verdes, and they're taking the small dogs and stuff, and it's really scary out there at night. I don't go out there at night for any reason, and I don't put the trash recycling and the poop. Yeah, if figure I put it there in the morning, I'll get it, or the girls get it. I don't put it out there for you. So I'm not that quick on the uptake, but I now realize that I've had this resentment that I've worked through. It has no basis in fact whatsoever. Right? It is a definition of a delusion. So I look at her, I go, I love you, babe. I got to go. Because I haven't talked about this. So I go to the meeting, and I'm telling the guys, because I figure I'll get some sympathy. But they're all taking me around telling, hey, they want the newcomers to realize what Lamb has done. Because apparently I'm there for amusement, right? And the point is, this is what we do. This is what I do. And as long as you don't drift into morbid reflection, it's just another day in a life. That's it. And I'll tell you, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you, I like to think of it as God's amusement park. And no, really, we're at God's amusement park. And you paid the price of admission if you're new. Nobody asked you if you wanted to pay. They just, alcoholism took it and robbed you from it. So you paid it. And you can leave any time, but you may not be able to pay the price again. Inside the park, it's like the meeting. You're in the meeting. You can come to me. You go to the meeting. Whatever. You do whatever you want. In the park, there's some rides, though. They're called the steps. And around the rides, there's 12 of them. There's people around the rides. They've been doing the rides for years, and they're just waiting for somebody to come. They just want to show you the ride. They want to take you on the ride. And you don't have to take the ride. But if you don't take the ride, you won't get the full amusement park benefit. And if you're new, I hope you take the ride. Thanks for having me.
All of our newcomers tonight, and Steve, one more time, please. All right, we're going to jump straight into the seventh tradition. There are no